Have you ever longed to escape reality? Or fantasized about stepping into someone else's shoes, even for just a little while? Hi, I'm Laura Mullen.
And I'm Chris Tolley. We host CBC's Play Me, the immersive podcast that transforms theater into addictive audio fiction. Join us for a new season and disappear into a world rich with drama, where every show delivers hypnotizing stories and unveils intriguing characters with secrets.
Play Me, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
The thing that excites me the most about the new Ryan Gosling movie, The Fall Guy, is that it reminds me of an era of big blockbusters that aren't just Marvel movies or sequels. But despite the great reviews, The Fall Guy didn't quite have a great opening weekend. Today on the podcast, why didn't The Fall Guy succeed? I'm Alameen Abdul Mahmoud. This is Commotion. Look, summer, yes, technically begins in June, but if you are a movie person, then really it starts in May. That's when studios start to put out their giant, or potentially giant, blockbusters, movies like this one.
Okay, I'm not the hero of this story. I'm just a stunt guy. Trying to look cool in front of the director of this movie. That's her, who I just so happen to have a major crush on.
We need to keep it super profesh.
Cool. Do you want to make out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
That is a trailer for The Fall Guy, which opened last Friday. Let me tell you a bit about The Fall Guy. The Fall Guy is a movie about a stuntman played by Ryan Gosling and a movie director played by Emily Blunt. And they've got this rocky romantic history. Then they also have to put their differences aside because the star of the movie that Emily Blunt is directing has gone missing under, let's say, dubious circumstances. I was excited about this movie. I was excited about The Fall Guy when we first saw the trailer and the rollout for it because I think it's the kind of movie that you used to hear people say, they just don't make movies like this anymore. You know, big explosions and big laughs and a big heart. But that did not seem to be enough because even though The Fall Guy was the number one movie at the box office, it fell quite short of expectations. It brought in $28.5 million. Yes, that's a lot of money, but for comparison's sake, if you think about the movie that opened May last year, and this weekend, and that was Guardians of the Galaxy 3, and that brought in $118 million on opening weekend. Two critics are here, Barry Hertz, Terry Hart. We got a lot to talk about. I'm really excited about this conversation. Barry and Terry, first of all, your names rhyme, but second of all, welcome to the show. How's it going, everybody?
Hey, Alameen. Hey, Barry.
Hey, how's it going?
I am excited to talk about this movie because it worked for me, and I will tell you the reasons why it worked for me in a moment. But I'm going to start with you, Terry. Tell me, what are your thoughts on this movie? Please don't hold anything back. Get in there.
It's pure joy. Okay. The Fall Guy is pure joy. Okay. I mean, it ticks so many boxes about a good time at the movies. If you like Ryan Gosling, check. If you like Emily Blunt, check. I mean, just if you love movies, check, because there's so many movie references in mm-hmm. it. Everything from Memento to Thelma and Louise to like a joke between Ryan and Emily or their characters about like mixing up Julia Roberts movies. It just has so much joy in it. I mean, the character that Ryan Gosling is doing stunts for, his name is Tom Ryder. I mean, do we need anything more than that? That is like really inside baseball. And except we can all enjoy it because we know exactly who they're referencing. And Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling are so charming in this movie. It is like every time there's a close-up of them, you want to hear that sparkly sound, that tweak sound, you know, from them, because they're just proper movie stars. Between the two of them and Zendaya, we are having a movie star summer.
Okay, so Terry, we should say Terry's not alone in loving this movie. It's gotten rave reviews from New York Magazine, The Guardian, Variety, and a bunch more. Barry, you wrote in The Globe that you were a bit lukewarm on this movie. I want to be upfront with you and tell you, I saw this tweet that was like, I could never be a movie critic because if I sit in a movie theater with like a large popcorn and drink, I'm just having a good time. That's how I felt about this movie. Why didn't you love it? Why are you lukewarm on this movie?
I think that it presents the facade of joy. This is like highly manufactured,
okay,
overly engineered studio noted joy. Mm. I think there's a great idea nestled within this movie, which is let's get Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling on screen together and let them go wild.
Yeah.
And that is great. And they are very charming and they're both excellent as they usually are. But the thing is that this movie is just like takes the idea of let's make a great show and kind of like beats it to death a little bit.
You think he's trying too hard is what you're saying.
It is a try hard movie. And I think that's exemplified by it's, you know, by the time we get to like that third act where I just found it was exhausting. I was like, I get it. Stunts. They're awesome. But
the people watching on YouTube will see this. The people listening on the radio will not see this, but Terry has had her arms up in the air waving wildly as you were talking. Go ahead, Terry. Go ahead. Go in.
You bring up the third act, and that is the absolute meta part of the movie. One of the storylines, like the D storyline in Fall Guy, is that the movie that Emily Blunt is directing has a third act problem, and so does Fall Guy. I mean, they both, and I do think that that is, I mean, part of the fun that they're both having.
Yeah.
Ryan and Emily are really, really smart actors, and they know exactly the movies that they want to make. And I think that they infuse that third act problem into Fall Guy to mirror all the meta things that are happening throughout the movie.
Now,
that's my take.
But the problem is, if you don't have a finished third act, you don't have a finished third act, whether it's for the movie that's on the screen or the movie that is about the movie that's on the screen. On that point, I got to side with Barry. I didn't think the ending of it was particularly great. But the thing that worked for me was that I couldn't take my eyes off Ryan Gosling off this movie. And mercifully, I didn't have to. I mean, like, he is there. It doesn't matter what he's doing. He's so just imminently watchable and so enjoyable. I found him really enjoyable in this movie. Can we just talk about the moment that Ryan Gosling is having? Because, like, of course, Barbie and, you know, I'm just Ken, but, like, at the Grammys, SNL, there's something kind of electric about Ryan Gosling in this moment. I kind of thought that that would be enough to get people through the door, Terry, in terms of, like, having this movie be as a really successful movie. Are you surprised by how good Ryan Gosling was and how all these reviews are raving about him, and yet not that many people walk through the door?
It's funny, you know, my husband said to me last week, has Ryan Gosling ever been in anything big? And I'm like, Bill, Barbie.
Yes.
And he's like, all right, of course. But there's something that Ryan Gosling has done, which is he started out his career as very much an indie actor. Mm-hmm. He was revered. He was nominated for an Academy Award for Half Nelson. He really had
you
that.
You didn't mention
kind of
Breaker
indie...
High, but I respect it. It's fine. I'll let it go. It's okay.
Yeah. And he did all those interesting things. But somewhere along the line, and I don't think it's that far along the line. Like, I think it's quite recent. He figured out what he needs to do to be a AAA movie star. Mm-hmm. And that's all those things that you mentioned. I remember doing the junket for Crazy Stupid Love, another great movie. If you haven't seen that movie, go see that movie. Mm-hmm. And people were walking out of those interviews with Ryan Gosling just ashen because he was not playing. Mm-hmm. And now he is an actor who plays. And that seems to have, you know, really allowed him to be that guy on SNL that breaks the fourth wall in every single skit. Mm-hmm. It allows him to do I'm Just Ken. But I wonder from the public's perception, if they still think, like the broad general public, if they still think he is this kind of really indie actor and is exactly what they want to see. I think he still has that in a positive way, and it could affect those opening weekend box office numbers.
Yeah, when I think about Ryan Gosling, Barry, the first two movies that come to mind, unfortunately, are Place Beyond the Pines and Blue Valentine. Excellent movies, but grim movies. Movies made by someone that you go like, I don't want to hang out with that person. That's like, there's a lot of darkness that is around this. He does appear to be sort of trying to change his story of who Ryan Gosling is publicly. And as far as I can tell, having a delightful time doing this publicly. I think that comes across in this movie. But then you see the box office performance of this movie. What do you make of the fact that they poured all this money into trying to be like, this is like the tentpole movies that you remember from your childhood, and then it didn't work? What do you make of that, Barry?
Well, first of all, great to have a Place Beyond the Pines Hive represented here.
Shout out Place Beyond the Pines. Great
Place
movie.
Place Beyond the Pines. Yes. This is, you know, it's an interesting case study for both Gosling and movie stars in general. I think we're kind of in the thick of this void of movie stars. Did anybody go to see Oppenheimer because Cillian Murphy was in it, or because they went because of Chris Nolan and everything that he brings to the table? Do people go to see Marvel movies because Chris Pratt is there, or do they go because they're Marvel movies? So that's kind of a problem. And Ryan Gosling is kind of, you know, walking into that quite unintentionally in this very interesting, weird, discombobulating era where movie stars themselves, names, cannot necessarily open a movie. And, you know, you combine that with, you know, this had a lack of really like brand recognizability. Yeah, it's the Fall Guy. I mean, poll anybody walking into that movie about, do you know Lee Majors? Do you know what Lee Majors means to this movie? And you will get blank stares.
Yes, that's true.
So there's a problem with there. And it's walking into a lot of different industry problems. You know, the rise of streaming. Universal is going to put this sucker on PVOD in like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And while that is a financially solid move from all reports in terms of, you know, earning their bucks back, it has conditioned audiences to not rush and to say, maybe I can wait just a little while and then I can watch it at home for a more cost-effective night of entertainment.
Terry, I'm interested in an argument that Barry just made, because I haven't heard that argument before. The idea that we are in a dearth of movie stars, or rather that a movie star is not enough to open a movie. When I think about the largest movies of the last couple of years, either they have to have been franchise movies or they've had like discourse, quote unquote, going for them, you know, and that sort of applies to Barbie, but also applies to Oppenheimer the same way. Like the idea of like, yeah, there's a Christopher Nolan hive, but also like it's sort of creating a larger moment. Do you think Barry's read is true? The idea that a movie star on their own is kind of insufficient to kind of make a movie land or open as big?
Yeah, I think Hollywood is scared. And I think that the days of them relying on a single person to open a movie, as Barry said, are gone. And they bet on Emily and Ryan here. And obviously, it was not a great bet. The movie's still great. I stand by that. But, you know, I went to see Challengers in the movie and in the theaters.
A discourse movie. There's discourse around that movie. But yes, continue.
And a movie star.
Yes,
right?
And
so they've got
star.
Zendaya and they've got discourse. And I do believe that Fall Guy, I will add to Barry's analysis to suggest that Fall Guy doesn't seem to have any of that water cooler moment.
No.
It's not something that you walk away from and you go, hey, did you know? But you say, like, I had a really fun time watching that movie. And is that enough? And I think the when we talk about movie stars, the line between movie stars and TV stars has blurred so significantly with, you know, the golden age of television.
Sure.
And if we can, are we still calling it that? And
you can if you want to. Yep.
I will. And so the idea of like, is that somebody I go to see in the movies or is that somebody I wait to watch in my house? I think those lines are very, very blurry for people when it used to be very delineated. It used to be like, if it's Tom Cruise, I'm in a movie theater. If it's Julia Roberts, I'm in a movie theater. You can't say that about Julia Roberts anymore. You can still say it about Tom Cruise.
I was going to say, like, Tom Cruise is kind of the exception here that proves the rule. Like, he's the only one that I'm like, no, if it's Tom Cruise, I'm in a movie theater. I'm not. But that's because his movies won't be on streaming. I mean, like, that's something that he sort of makes a point of doing, is like he doesn't do the things that are available on streaming.
Well, go ahead, Barry.
Oh, I was just guessing. And we're seeing kind of the twilight of Tom Cruise as well.
Hey,
the last mission. Listen, I'm Tom Cruise fan number one. I will jump off any cliff he wants me to anytime. But the last Mission Impossible underperformed. And it did so for a number of reasons, one of which was the Barbenheimer phenomenon butting right up against it.
Sure.
But we're still he is not immune to that. And I mean, you know, Fall Guy, of course, has some fun with the Tom Cruise phenomenon.
Sure does.
But I mean, we're also seeing he is opening those movies because, again, those Mission Impossible movies are MI franchise backed.
Yeah.
Is Tom Cruise going to be able to open an original rom-com? I don't know. I mean, I'll go see it, but.
Well, I was thinking actually of the Tom Cruise movie that he did with Emily Blunt from a few years ago, which, what was it, The Day After Tomorrow? It's not The Day After Tomorrow.
That's exactly, it was The Day of, no, that was a Jake Gyllenhaal.
I wish I could remember what
it was
called.
The Edge of Tomorrow.
The Edge of Tomorrow, thank you. That's like a good movie that, you know, did really well, but also that was 10 years ago. We just don't live in that same world anymore. Listen, before I let you go, Barry, just last word to you here. In your review of The Fall Guy, you noted how action comedies were just like a really popular genre in the 80s and 90s, but a lot harder to come by these days. Why do you think that is? Why do you think we don't make action comedies as much?
I think because both of those genres have been co-opted by mega franchise machines. Hmm. The Marvel stuff, that's the new action comedy because it is this fantasist, sci-fi, thriller kind of thing. But baked into those movies is a very strong line of comedy and humor. Right. And audiences know that they're going to get all of that, like an all-you-can-eat genre buffet when they go to a Marvel movie versus like – and they're going to get – you know, they're invested in the story. They want to see how part XYZ turns out. And they're like, oh, well, I'm going to do that, or I'm going to go see The Fall Guy, which I think my dad watched as a kid that has some kind of TV series. And maybe it's an action – I don't know. I don't know. Maybe, you know, it's too complicated. I'm not going to go see it. I'm just going to look at Ryan Gosling memes at home while I'm watching a Marvel movie on a second screen.
Terry, what do you make of that argument? The idea that Marvel sort of borrowed the grammar from so many of the genres we love and has kind of, you know, by borrowing that grammar, has kind of cornered the market, at least for younger generations who are like, you know what? Now I go to those movies for this kind of genre, this idea of experiencing an action comedy instead of, you know, I don't know, watching The Fugitive or something.
Yeah, I agree with Barry. I would add to that, you know, The Fall Guy doesn't have any, you know, ancillary money-making machine behind it. It doesn't have action figures. It doesn't have all of the things that the IP, mentioning again when I went to see Challengers, literally every single trailer before that was a sequel, a prequel, or something IP. I mean, one of the reasons that I'm celebrating Fall Guy, yes, it's, you know, loosely based on a show from the 80s, but I mean, it feels fresh. It feels like there's something new in there. I don't know those characters in the way that, you know, you reference Guardians of the Galaxy number three, which opened this time last year.
You spent like 10 years with them. Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, yes, there are, you know, to say again, it ticks all those boxes that we know that movie is going to deliver on because it's just the sausage machine of Kevin Feige and MCU. But I mean, isn't it nice to go and meet new people? Isn't it nice to go and see some new stunts directed by somebody that doesn't have an entire second unit behind them?
Me and you, we agree on this. Barry says, you should go meet new people, just not with The Fall Guy. We got to leave it there. Barry Hearst, Terry Hart, you guys are the best. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks.
Pleasure. Terry Hart is an entertainment reporter in Toronto. Barry Hearst is a film critic for the Globe and Mail, also in Toronto. You can, and I would say you should, go see The Fall Guy in theaters right now.
Hey, I'm journalist Sam Sanders.
I'm poet Saeed Jones.
And I'm producer Zach Stafford. And we are the hosts of a podcast called Vibe Check.
On Vibe Check, we talk about everything. News, culture, and entertainment, and how it all feels.
That's right. We talk about any and everything on our show, from real-life issues like grief to music and movie critiques. And that barely scratches the surface.
Yes, indeed. And it doesn't stop there. We have got a lot to say. So join our group chat, come to life. Follow and listen to Vibe Check wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Alameen Abdul-Mahmoud, and this is Commotion. We're going to shift gears now. Last month, Canada lost one of our great documentarians. Roger McTerr was one of the first Black Canadian documentary filmmakers, and for decades, he examined the Black Canadian experience through his work. His 1975 doc, Some Black Women, explored the role Black women played in the 70s era Canada. I want to play you a bit of this right now.
The problems that are facing Black women in the city or in the province are basically the same kinds of problems facing all women, plus the fact that we have to suffer from racism And that for the immigrant woman, certainly, there's the additional strain of struggling to make it in a new society.
Roger would make more groundbreaking documentaries with partner and fellow pioneering black documentarian Claire Prato, including the 1987 film Home to Buxton, which explored the lives of the residents of one of Ontario's earliest black settlements. McTerra was also a writer, a poet, and a media writing teacher at Seneca College for 18 years. He died last month from complications of Parkinson's disease. He was 80. Ian Kamau is the son of Roger McTerra and Claire Prato. He's also an artist and a culture critic. Ian, welcome to the show. And sorry for your loss, man.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Listen, this past Saturday, your family held a public celebration for Roger McTerra's life and legacy. What was that like for you? What was it like for you to see the community come together and note the way that your dad changed lives?
It was wonderful for me. Obviously, it was difficult, yeah. But I don't really believe in like capital C community anymore. I really believe just in relationships.
Mm.
My father had very good relationships over a long period of time, very good friends, colleagues who stayed with him for many, many years, many students on not just over the time that he taught at Seneca, but both official students, like people that he taught. He used to teach Black history in high school. Hmm. He taught media and culture writing, as you said, at Seneca College. But he also just naturally was a teacher. He taught people by you just standing around him, being next to him, sitting with him, engaging in a conversation with him. So I was very happy to see the impact in physical form, like with people being in the room and all the messages that I got from people that expressed their condolences and said they wish they could be there.
I really love that idea of believing in relationships and then seeing those relationships kind of come manifest. So both your parents, Roger and Claire, were two of the first black filmmakers in Canada. They had this laser-focused experience on the experience of black Canadian, on the lived experience of black Canadians. I'm told you spent a lot of time, you know, on set and in community meetings with them. Do you have any sort of cherished memories that you want to share of your father in those settings, maybe?
I remember my father sitting on a lawn, like in the side of a parking lot somewhere in Jane and Finch, talking to a bunch of guys.
Yeah.
I remember just a million conversations between him and multiple people. He introduced me to a lot of people, including the people in those films, Stanley Grizel, Bromley Armstrong. I could go on and on. But I think obviously he has a legacy around film and writing and poetry and education. But I think the thing that I remember and think about him most, and the thing that makes me most emotional in terms of my memories, is his relationships with people, is friendships, people that he cared about, people that he asked for, even when he was sick, the way that he would speak to people, speak to family. Everybody that knows him knows he was a very serious person, but he was also liked to laugh. He had a dark sense of humor. He was funny as hell. And I love seeing him with his friends, whether it was in the process of making something or whether it was just hanging out or liming, as they would say in Trinidad.
When you say you really like loved the way that he spoke to people, what do you mean by that? Well, how did he speak to people?
I mean, my dad was no BS.
Hmm.
He loved the presence of people. He loved a good conversation. He loved an intellectual conversation as much as he loved a stupid conversation. he loved music. He yeah. loved film. He loved, you know, he could talk about Lord Kitchener and Sparrow and Otis Redding, but he could also talk about what was happening and, you know, in the news at the moment, sure. what how he used to hang out with his friends on the corner in Trinidad at Erthig Road and Casaubon Lane, the Zobes crew. He could talk about a lot of things, you know? Mm-hmm. So he was always engaging with people and having conversations of all kinds. And I was often there for a lot of those conversations.
Ian, you yourself became a storyteller, which is not surprising. What parts of your father's legacy have resonated, do you think, with you as you've approached being an artist?
You know, I've been speaking to a lot of people over the last month.
Yeah.
And what I tell them is that, like, I get up in the morning and I look in the mirror and I see him. I see him wow. in me, not just in face, but so much, if not all of who I am is because of my parents and my father's love of music, his love of writing, his love of film, all his political viewpoints, his his the way that he dealt with the people in his community, all of those things are the things that are most important and valuable to me. So there is no one thing. I am my father's son.
That's a beautiful way to put it. I think if somebody was looking to start with one of your father's films, is there one that you would say, this is my favorite and here's why you should start with it? Can you even pick one?
I love a lot of them for different reasons. Home feeling, Jennifer Hodge, A Struggle for a Community, Home to Buxton. Mm-hmm. I think the one that I would recommend to people most, especially Canadians, Black Canadians specifically, but all Canadians, is Journey to Justice. Hmm. I first learned about Viola Desmond through that film. This is years and years before she was on our $10 bill. My personal favorite is Home to Buxton, but the one that I would recommend is Journey to Justice, and you can find them both online.
Well, Ian, I really appreciate your time, man. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Of course. Roger McTeer did so much in his lifetime to spotlight the lived Black Canadian experience, not just as a filmmaker, but as a writer, poet, and a teacher. I got to say, I'm really grateful for this. Ian Kamau is an artist and a culture critic, and also the son of the late documentarian, poet, and teacher, Roger McTeer. Roger died last month from complications of Parkinson's disease. He was 80 years old. You can right now find several of Roger McTeer's films at the National Film Board of Canada's website. That is it for the podcast today. You can find us on YouTube. You can find us on Instagram. We are at Commotion CBC. My name is Alameen Abdul Mahmoud. I'll see you tomorrow.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.